I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We have a quorum present. Before we get to the agenda, just a few things that we note before every hearing. Everyone here must be seated when they're in the hearing room. There's no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need any accommodations, please let staff know. Signs aren't permitted in the hearing room or at the testifiers' table and should be left outside. Clapping and other disruptions aren't allowed. And all of the testifiers who have been signed up in advance have been provided with a time limit. And if members of the public wish to testify on any of the bills, we will provide you with a time limit as well. And it's just so that we can keep the agenda moving and make sure that our members have time to fully discuss bills and amendments. Before we get going, we need to approve the March 19, 2024 minutes. Representative Hewitt, would you like to move approval of the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All those in favor of the March 19, 2024 minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevailed, and the minutes for March 19, 2024 are approved. First bill on the agenda is House File 3966. It's a Representative Wolgamott bill. I will move to lay over House File 3966. I don't believe you have an amendment, and I do believe that Representative Igo is co-presenting, so come on forward. Welcome to you both to the committee. And I don't know who's going to start, but whichever one of you, please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Well, Madam Chair, Lee Novotny, members of the Public Safety Committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight to present House File 3966, a bill to amend the definition of public safety telecommunicator and establish minimum training and certification standards. Since the first 911 call was made in the state of Minnesota back in 1968, the work performed by Minnesota's public safety telecommunicators has evolved significantly as new technology has been introduced and public expectations regarding the level and quality of service they receive has increased. I had the opportunity to see that firsthand over the legislative interim. I did a six-hour-long sit-along with my friend, Dispatcher Nicole Bauman, and it was an incredible experience, Madam Chair and members. The work that our 911 public safety telecommunicators do, the multitasking, the intense situations, they are the first responders, and they deserve to have the support from the state that they need to do their jobs and keep us safe. But surprisingly, Madam Chair and members, there are currently no statewide training and certification requirements governing these first responders who staff Minnesota's 103 public safety answering points. And while the Minnesota legislature has established these requirements for other public safety disciplines, like law enforcement, firefighters, EMTs, Minnesota is one of the few states in the nation that has not passed legislation to define minimum training and certification requirements for PSTs. That's why we're bringing forward House File 3966. I'll walk you through the bill. Section 1 of the bill amends the definition of 911 telecommunicator in statute. It establishes a public safety telecommunicator training and standards board and has criteria for qualification on the board and the responsibilities of the board. Section 3 establishes that public safety telecommunicators must be certified by the commissioner of DPS. Section 4 amends the approved uses of the 911 emergency telecommunications service account in the special revenue fund to include public safety telecommuter training certification and continuing education. And lastly, Section 5 appropriates $1.45 million in fiscal year 2024 and $1 million ongoing from the 911 emergency telecommunications service account to the Department of Public Safety to establish and review the certification and continuing education standards that are developed in Section 3. That is why we're bringing the bill forward. That's what the bill does. And Madam Chair, I do want to acknowledge that while I'm here presenting the bill today, this wouldn't be possible without countless hours of hard work and collaboration from countless members of the legislature and within the law enforcement services. And I'm very proud to be presenting this bill with my friend from the other side of the aisle, Representative Spencer Igo, who we would not be able to have a bill before us today without his dedication to standing up for 911 public safety telecommunicators, the work of his predecessor, Representative Sandy Lehman, Again, this bill is a collaboration of many people. I'm very grateful to Representative Igoe for his work on this issue, and I'm very proud to be here today co-presenting the bill with him. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members.
Thank you. Hi, Representative Igoe. Welcome to the committee. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Wolgamott. Like you said, this has been an issue that's been worked on a very long time. My predecessor, Representative Lehman, started working on this in 2017, and in that time, we had to work on actually getting a task force put together to get where we're at today established, and that took a long time. We didn't get that passed until 2021, and as Representative Wolgamott has been saying, it required law enforcement agencies and personnel from all over the state to come together and say, how are we going to get this done? And that's why we have some of the language we have in front of us today. But this group of individuals, our telecommunicators, are a real critical line of defense when we call 911. You know, I think that's something it's we take for granted. When we need help, when we need to call somebody, it's, I know I can call or text 911 and someone's going to be there. These telecommunicators do a fantastic job. And for us as a state to be moving forward today on getting them the certifications and the standards and the training that they have been doing a long time and getting everyone on the same page is well-earned and well-deserved. And I'm glad we're taking a step today in a bipartisan way to get this done for all those people across our state so they can keep us all safe. So thank you to Representative Wolgamott for having me, and thank you to the committee for giving this a hearing.
All right, great. And it looks like your testifier is at the table. Nicole Bauman, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nicole Bauman. I'm a 911 dispatcher with Stearns County Sheriff's Office, and I've served in this position for 7 years. The Stearns County Dispatch Center is the ninth busiest center out of 112 dispatch centers in the state. I dispatch police, fire, and EMS for all of Stearns County and its small town partners, as well as St. Cloud Police and Fire Departments. I'm certified in emergency medical dispatching, FEMA, CPR, BCA, MNJIS, crisis negotiations, stress identification and management, missing and exploited children, response for first responders, and others. I'm also on the board of directors for law enforcement emergency services, director of law enforcement labor services, and Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. LELS, MPPUA, and I support House File 3966, which creates appropriate training and education requirements for 911 dispatchers, a standards board, a certification process, and more. Dispatchers are a vital part of the public safety responder team. We provide critical life-saving work every day and should be recognized and classified as first responders versus clerical employees. Without dispatchers, the public safety systems would not be able to function properly. Dispatchers are many times the first of the first responders to an incident, taking a call, creating a computer-aided dispatch record, and sending critical resources to the scene. This requires listening skills, the ability to multitask, data entry, launch, and coordinate resources to the scene, but most importantly, we provide life-saving measures to the caller over the phone prior to police, fire, and ambulance getting to the scene. This includes CPR instructions on how to deliver a baby, a stroke diagnostic, and more. In addition, it requires a baseline knowledge of each first responding department. 911 dispatchers are the beating heart of law enforcement and the lifeline of first responders on the scene. On behalf of LELS, MPPUA, and myself, we urge your support for this important bill, which supports all of our Minnesota dispatchers. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony and for your work. We appreciate it. We did have one member of the public sign up in advance, LaVey Robinson. So come on down to the testifiers table. And then are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. And once you get to the table, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is LaVey Robinson, and I'm here on behalf of the Public Safety Telecommunications Associations of APCO and NENA, that's the National Emergency Number Association, and as a representative of the Emergency Communications Center of the Bloomington Police Department. I have been a telecommunicator for over 30 years, and as a veteran of emergency communications, I believe legislation is not only necessary but imperative for the well-being of those that we serve. Public safety telecommunicators are the unsung heroes who serve as a first-line response during emergencies. Their ability to remain calm under pressure, communicate effectively, and coordinate critical resources is unparalleled. However, the crucial role they play often goes unrecognized and undersupported. This bill aims to rectify that by establishing comprehensive training standards and certification requirements for public safety telecommunicators, otherwise known as dispatchers, by ensuring that these professionals receive the necessary education and accreditation. We're going to empower them to handle emergencies with efficiency, accuracy, and compassion across the state of Minnesota. Furthermore, standardized training and certification will elevate the professionalism of public safety telecommunicators, enhancing public trust and confidence in emergency response services. It will also provide telecommunicators with the recognition and support they deserve, ultimately leading to improved job satisfaction and retention rates. In essence, the passage of this bill is not just about investing in the training and certification of public safety telecommunicators. It's about investing in the safety of the well-being of every individual within our communities. I urge you to consider the profound impact this legislation will have on the public safety and wholeheartedly support its swift enactment. Thank you for attention to this critical matter.
Thank you for your testimony and for your work as well. We appreciate it. We'll move on to member discussion. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and Igo and Wolgamont, thank you so much for this. I did, as I've been looking at the bill that Representative Igo had presented, which does have a Senate companion, and compared it to this one, I noticed that Representative Igo did not have, following the recommendations from the task force, did not have an oversight board, but instead had it through public safety. What was the reason of going ahead and creating an oversight board instead of using the recommendations from the task force?
Representative Wolgamott.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Mueller. I should have mentioned that I did have some author's amendments in the mix of being prepared for this hearing. Chair Mueller requested that out of respect for the time of this committee that we not go forward with any author's amendments, but I'm working with Representative Igo and the other stakeholders to make sure that gets ironed out.
Right. Yeah. And because the bill was being laid over and out of respect for staff, that was why. So we'll be able to work on amendments. Go ahead.
As I said, as of when I got this research memo, there isn't a Senate companion, whereas with Igo's bill, there is a Senate companion. Do we know how this is going to work?
Representative Wolgamott.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Mueller.
Mueller,
excuse me. Mueller, tomato, tomato. My apologies.
Not the same.
Again, we're working together in collaboration and partnership. Senator Lang is carrying the Senate file of Representative Igo's bill, and we're working in conjunction to make sure that these policies being put forward are advancing through the proper bodies.
Thank you. All right. Representative Kern.
Thank you, Chair, and I just want to say thank you to Reps Wolgamott and Igo for the bill. As a former dispatcher, I really appreciate your attention to this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Further, Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you guys for bringing this bill forward, and thank you for your service as a 911 dispatcher. You guys are always the first voice of any critical incident people hear. My only question was with the post board. Will there be licenses, and will there be things that would take those licenses away from being a dispatcher?
Representative Wolgamott.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Witte. Yeah, our intent is to just make sure that we have a good standard of qualification for that. And, of course, if there's any misconduct or cause to have that removed, we want to make sure that we have that option available because we want to be able to have a high standard. But, again, would appreciate your input, Representative Igo's input, as we move this bill forward.
Representative Woody.
Thank you. I think having that standardization, having that certification, having that high bar is good. I was just looking on the backside if there is complaints. Is this where that would go to? So, yeah, I'd be happy to help you guys.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Representative Pinot.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, representatives. We've got Wolgamott and Igo. There we go. I figured I'd take advantage of this time to note the need for training for dispatchers regarding and telecommunicators regarding exploitation and trafficking. So I did some training a number of years ago all over the state, but that included for those telecommunicators. And I don't know that that's continued so much. And so sort of as long as I have this this audience and this thought that there's, of course, a lot that needs to be that training could include for telecommunicators and responding to domestic violence situations, et cetera. But kind of just want to put in a plug. I've certainly seen as a prosecutor how important it is to have people who really can handle those calls well. And I felt like that training we did back in the day went quite well. And so kind of want to just encourage maybe we bring that back. So thanks to you both. Thanks, Madam Chair.
All right. Anything further? All right. Well, thank you once again. As a prosecutor who handles appeals, I have listened to many a 911 call and very much appreciate the great work you do and the hard work that you have. You're hearing people in their sometimes their most stressful and anxious, provoking moments, and you're trying to be a voice of calm and help for them. So thank you so much for that work. Any closing remarks, Representative Wolgamott or Igo?
Well, again, Madam Chair, Lee Novotny, members, thank you for the opportunity to present House File 3966. Our entire state owes a debt of gratitude to Dispatcher Bauman and her fellow public safety telecommunicators across the state for the crucial, life-saving work that they do on the front lines of public safety in our state. We can give them the respect and the support that they deserve by passing House File 3966. I look forward to continuing to build off of the incredible work that's been done by Representative Igo, and once again thank him for his hard work, and look forward to working with all of you to enact House File 3966, and I ask for your support.
Representative Igo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just close in saying, you know, the legislature may have done a lot of work on this, but there's a lot of unsung heroes that have worked across the state, many names in our public safety and our public safety telecommunicators that have been working again on this for over a decade. And this moment here, this committee hearing tonight, is us moving in the right direction to finally get this done for the safety of all Minnesotans and the respect and dignity of those who answer the calls when we are in our time of need. So thank you to the committee, and thanks for getting this bill heard, and let's move it forward. Thank you.
All right. Thanks to you both. And I will renew the motion and lay over House File 3966.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members.
Thanks. Next, we have Representative Holland's bill, House File 2319. And I believe that your motion, Representative Holland, is that House File 2319 be placed on the general register.
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
Okay. And you don't have any amendments that I see, so please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you. The purpose of this bill is to exclude a confession made when an officer knowingly communicates false facts about the existence of evidence related to specific criminal conduct, or if they communicate unauthorized statements regarding leniency. And I'm going to cede the rest of my time to the experts in this area.
All right, very well. I see Andrew Marquardt's already at the table, so thanks for being here. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mohler, members of the committee. My name is Andrew Marquardt. I'm a managing attorney at Great North Innocence Project. We work to prevent and remedy wrongful convictions. So in 1942, John Reed and Fred Inbal published their first interrogation manual, and that was the starting point for what would become known as the Reed technique, which would become the prevailing interrogation method in America in the second half of the 20th century. Now, most relevant for our purposes, along with many other tactics, that technique embraced the use of false evidence as part of an effort to extract confessions. Now, Fred Inbal said back in 1942 that these methods would not lead an innocent person to confess. Now, part of the reason my organizations like mine exist is that that statement's been proved false hundreds of times over. One of those cases is the case of our client, Terry Olson, who put in a letter that I would encourage you to read. Now, in Fred Inbal's defense, we didn't know that much about false confessions back in 1942. It really wasn't until DNA came around and we had waves of exonerations that we really understood how often false confessions occur. And in those DNA exonerations, they showed up in about 30% of cases. And let's keep in mind that in each one of those wrongful convictions, the flip side of that is that the guilty person went free and was able to potentially cause additional harm. So this is very much a public safety issue. Now, in 1942, we also didn't know that much about what made for good police interviews and interrogations. Since then, however, there's been a tremendous amount of scientific research that has shed new light on this field in terms of what works, what doesn't work. That research has been unfriendly to the false evidence ploy. And that's why the trend today in policing is really to move away from these tactics. You see that in the federal government, with the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center abandoning these tactics. By the way, that's been a bipartisan policy over multiple administrations. You see that in local law enforcement agencies around the country. Closer to home, our own BCA does not use the false evidence ploy. Now, are all these groups trying to take away a valuable law enforcement tool that could help public safety? Of course not. What they've recognized is that our policing is better off without it. So over the years, our organization has worked with legislators of both parties, with law enforcement groups, to help promote best practices in policing, because we want what I think everyone here wants, which is to make Minnesota the gold standard for high-quality 21st century policing. And at its core, that's what this bill is about. It'll help improve public confidence in the integrity of policing. It'll help prevent wrongful convictions. So I hope you'll support this bill, and I'm happy to stand by for any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. And I believe your other testifiers up here as well, Mark Fallon. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mark Fallon. I'm a retired NCIS special agent and a lifetime member of the International Association of Chiefs of Police. I'm the immediate past chair of the IMPACT section, which is the International Managers of Police Academy and College Trainers. I served 4 years as a chair and the previous 4 years as the vice chair of that committee. I'm a member of the IACP Police Research Advancement Section, and I've spent, after 3 decades in federal law enforcement, I spent the last decade and a half being involved in interrogation research and trying to bridge the gap between the science and practice of interrogation. As a visiting scholar at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, which I did for 3 years, I was a co-editor of a book called Interview and Interrogation, A History of Research and Practice Since World War II. We tried to chronicle the continuum of interrogation tactics that have been used. We brought 50 experts in from around the world to write 24 chapters. And as an initiative of the IACP, we made sure that the electronic version of that book is available free, so that law enforcement officers can download it and review it and start to improve the practice. It was just published in December. In 2000, I was the chief investigator for the Al-Qaeda Terrorist Network for Military Commissions, and I ran the task force doing that. And what we found was we were getting a lot of bad information, a lot of inaccurate and unreliable information. And in 2005, President Bush and the Office of Director of National Intelligence commissioned a study. He asked the Intelligence Science Board to take a look at why we were getting all this bad information. What they found was they did a study, and they found that it had been more than 50 years, 50 years, since the U.S. government had invested any money into why a guy like me would get someone to talk to me in an interrogation. We were using customary learning, things that were handed down. The Army field manual was based on legacy, and there was no, what they found was none of it was based on science. It was not evidence-based. They went to the FBI Academy. They went to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. They went to the Boston Police Department. And so what happened was in 2009, when President Obama took office, he took a look at this and said, while we're not going to torture anymore, we do need to know the most effective means of obtaining accurate and reliable information to protect our national security. Since that time, the high-value detainee interrogation group formed a research committee, and I was the chair of that committee. And there have been over 150 funded government research projects that have resulted in more than 225 peer-reviewed scientific publications and journals on how to improve the practice of effective interviewing. When I was the assistant director for training of the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, we were not using science-based methods to teach our law enforcement officers. They do now. When I was the director of the NCIS Training Academy, we were not using science to improve the practice of interrogation. They are now. There's a whole movement underway, and there's pockets of excellence around the country of departments that are embracing the research. They totally revamped the training at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. Now every Secret Service agent, every ATF agent, every U.S. Marshal, NCIS, OSI, everyone who goes through FLETC, when I was the assistant director, we had about 3,000 a day in daily residential training, about 30,000 a year as our annual throughput, they are all now receiving this new science-based methods. The problem with those legacy methods, which were from the 40s, these confession-driven practices, is they are effective in obtaining confessions from a guilty person, as well as an innocent person. What the new research shows is, if you evolve to these information-gathering methods, rapport-based methods, that you obtain more accurate, reliable information, less false information, and more admissions. And so not only is it better, it's easier because it's easier to train in this. So what I would urge you to do is to support this bill. If truth matters, science must matter. And just as we wouldn't allow a law enforcement officer to issue them a weapon that frequently misfires and its unintended targets, we should not do so with our interrogation methodologies. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for your service. Do we have any members of the public who wish to testify? I am not seeing any, so we can move on to member discussion. Representative Novotny.
Chair Waller, I see the executive director of the Chiefs of Police Associations in the audience, Mr. Potts. He's expressed some concerns in the letter. I was wondering if he wanted to specifically address this or if I could ask him some questions on this.
Sure, we do have time for that too. So come on down, Chief Potts. Go ahead and ask your question maybe while he's heading down.
Chief Potts, with all the things that are already in place in the state of Minnesota, scales, mandatory recording of the confessions, all the court rules that are already in place, that we're, as a police officer, bringing a bill to an attorney for there be prosecution, don't we already have the presumption that the interview is inadmissible and you have to prove that it was given with voluntary intentions? I mean, it's already the burden of the proof of the prosecutors to show that this is a voluntary confession and it wasn't coerced already, right?
Chief Potts, please introduce yourself too for the record.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Jeff Potts, the Executive Director for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. Madam Chair and Representative Novotny, our association along with the MPPOA and the Sheriff's Association did essentially provide that as input and feedback on the bill, that there are protocols in place. The judicial system itself does have safeguards. Now, I'm not going to 100% dispute that the science, that there is some science and that is evolving. But I think our association, at least, is still not convinced that science is complete. And I think if this were to pass, I think Minnesota would be the only state in the country that would accept that science in all cases, both adult and juveniles. And so we're monitoring this science and trying to ensure that we don't end up in a situation where that perhaps our efforts, as you've mentioned, that the system does have some safeguards to protect admissibility of statements, we might end up in a situation where that doesn't work exactly how we had hoped. And so we don't support the bill as it stands right now. I think if it were to be limited to juveniles, that the cognitive ability and the brain of a juvenile, that there may be a stronger case that the science supports that at this time. But we aren't in a position right now to support it for all cases for the systems and protocols and safeguards that you just mentioned.
And last question for you, Chief Potts.
Representative Novotny.
Last question for you, Chief Potts. Would you concur that it is the position of the agencies that you represent and that were on this letter that none of them want a false confession and none of them want an innocent person to be held accountable and a guilty person to go free?
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair and Representative Novotny, absolutely.
Thank you, Chief. I have one last question for the person from Mr. Marquardt for the Great North Innocence Project.
Sure, you can come, Sarah. Why don't you stay there, Chief Potts, because I have a question for you as well. All right, Mr. Marquardt's back at the table. Go ahead and ask your question.
Mr. Marquardt, reading your, you've got the letter that you put out about this case with Terry Olson and a false confession. Has something changed in the laws? Because I was always under the assumption in the cases that I worked that you couldn't go off of, you couldn't get a conviction just based on a co-conspirator's admission. Is there something in this case that you cite as the reason that we should have this that I don't understand and hasn't already been covered in Minnesota case law?
Mr. Marquardt.
Thank you, Chair Mullen, and thank you for the question, Lee Nemutney. So I think it would be overstatement, and it wasn't intended to be the representation that the statement from his co-conspirator was the only piece of evidence in that case. So, yes, I guess if that were the only piece of evidence, perhaps that would not be sufficient. But it was a major pillar of the case against him, and I think likely he would not have been convicted but for the testimony of his alleged co-conspirator, which was extracted through a interrogation method that relied on the false evidence ploy.
Lead Nabotny.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, I do have a question for you too, Mr. Marquardt, if you can stay there. So I think the sort of assertion has been made that current law, because of the voluntariness of a confession or not, is sufficient, so we don't need this. And I would like you to address what the law actually allows with respect to lying and still maintaining a voluntary confession, if you could.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Happy to speak to that. So the current standard is, yes, voluntariness is the key legal issue, which is evaluated under a totality of the circumstances, which means that you consider, you know, all factors that go to addressing this question of whether the statement was really the product of someone's free will or whether their will was somehow overcome based on the circumstances. So the use of deception under current law could be part of that analysis. You know, the Supreme Court of our state has cautioned law enforcement. In one case, say that you walk on thin ice when you use these tactics, but it's not a per se basis for excluding. I think in response to your question, as well as to some of the points in the law enforcement letter, I think our perspective is that standard doesn't address the full slate of concerns that we have with this practice. So we are certainly concerned with voluntariness. Obviously, that is part of the concern. We're also concerned with reliability, which the U.S. Supreme Court has said is a separate issue from voluntariness. So you do have cases, and Saul Kasson is a psychologist who's probably the leading expert in this area, who's written about these cases quite a bit, where you have people who, it's not necessarily involuntary, but, for example, let's say you tell someone that they were caught on videotape committing the crime. Well, in their head, they think, well, I know that couldn't possibly have been me, but I know I also want to get out of this room because this is terribly uncomfortable. So I'm just going to confess to get out of this current situation, and then we'll look at the tape and we'll sort this out later. That's not what happens in most cases. Once you've confessed, it's extraordinarily difficult to unring that bell. So you have cases where it's not involuntary per se, but it's unreliable. You also have just concerns about you know, promoting the general perception of integrity of law enforcement practices, which is part of this, and just the concerns that it's a bad tactic, which is part of what we talked about. So I think there's a broader slate of concerns motivating this bill that aren't covered by the current legal standard.
Okay, great. Yeah, thank you so much. And as I said before, when this was in judiciary, I really feel like this is more about training tactics of the past. It's not about individual officers doing bad things. This is about poor training practices in the past that now we have the scientific evidence. Now that we know better, we should do better. And that's really how I feel about it. And I do have a question for you, Chief Potts, if you can come back. And you and I have talked a little bit about this bill, and it's been narrowed a lot, which I really appreciate. I was opposed. People know I was opposed to it when it came last year because it was so broad, and I felt like every single sentence was going to be litigated. And I'm really happy with how the groups have worked to really narrow this into really two things, where during the interrogation, the officer knowingly communicates false facts about the existence or nature of evidence to the extent such evidence would be material, or communicated, again, knowingly communicated unauthorized statements regarding leniency. And I'm still trying to really understand what's problematic with that language, if you could, Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, just, I guess we're slightly reiterate some of the comments I made before. The you know, knowingly part, I think there was some, in one of the meetings we had, there was some discussion about at what point does the statement become inadmissible? And I don't think that's been clarified in this version of the bill. That is the entire statement inadmissible because the detective knowingly made an untruthful statement? I guess that part we still have some concerns about, that perhaps there is a portion, but there were several statements very relative and material to the state, to the interview, that perhaps shouldn't be inadmissible. So I think there was pieces of that. And I think we still, as I mentioned before, we're still trying to, I think, assess where we're at with regard to the science. And make sure, you know, if this is such widely understood and clear, we don't see any other states that have made the decision to do this yet. And I'm not saying we shouldn't lead the country in certain things. I'm not sure I can speak on behalf of my members and say that we are completely confident that the science is, that this is truly the best thing for public safety. I think we can get there and agree to it with regard to interviewing tactics for juveniles and how they process information and the tendency that or likelihood that it may lead to confessions when perhaps that's not accurate. But I think we still are in a place of somewhat questioning this, and there are some safeguards in place at least now that determine whether or not a statement should be admissible or not.
All right, Representative Pinto.
Thanks, Chair, and I just want to note how much more persuasive statements are to juries when they are not. When there's not a false statement made. So it's so often when we have criminal legal reforms, they're not only better for the defendant's rights, which is good, they actually are better for the prosecution as well, because then the jury has much more confidence. So this is an example of something that actually having this to my mind means that then when we present the case, you can have much more confidence. And Chair, when you were walking through how narrow and reasonable this is, I know that you'd gotten to paragraph B that even has a fail-safe. As well, that the state can in fact show that even if there was something, or this presumption that as long as you can show by preponderance of the evidence, which is a pretty low standard, that it was voluntary, reliable, and non-induced. So I think this is a really good proposal. I appreciate Representative Hollins.
Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I guess I'm a little confused with the scales where once you've been read your Miranda warning, and it kind of states that you are taping or videotaping. And this would be more for my prosecutor friends across the aisle. Wouldn't that be the safety net? You got the audio and the video, and you would just disregard the whole statement right there. I don't know what this new law achieves because you get that as it's presented to you to make the decision. I think that's the fail switch right there. You're reviewing the cases, and then if you don't think it's admissible, you drop the case.
So the scales requirement is just the requirement of the recording, but if there's been these tactics that have been used and somebody confesses falsely, you have it on tape. I mean, that's what you have, is you have it on tape, but to what was said, it's really hard to unring that bell once somebody makes a confession to something.
And I appreciate that, Chair Mueller, but wouldn't you be able to dismiss the case on that basis right there? That's already in current law, and that's what I think scales provided law enforcement at the time, that you had to start recording, you had to start, and I think most departments even do the videotaping, so you can see if there's a false statement, you would then be able to pull the case or that statement. They'd have to have other evidence. Maybe I'm missing a piece in all this.
Yeah, I mean, I think with all of these things, there's some level of prosecutorial discretion. Maybe that's what you're saying, but this would be a standard of if these things actually happen, these knowingly making these false statements or knowingly communicating unauthorized statements, then we're going to assume it's inadmissible unless these other parts of paragraph B can be established. So it provides some consistency in a standard.
So we currently do not have that. You guys don't have the ability to say we're not going to prosecute this case because didn't meet that standard?
Well, I think this creates consistency. That's what I'm saying. This is the standard. This creates a consistent standard.
Thank you.
I don't know if any of the any of our experts wanted to comment on that further. No. Okay.
No, you handled it really well.
All right. Sorry. I feel like, I'm more engaged in this discussion than I normally am. So.
But you guys are in the field. You guys understand right. it. I'm trying to understand it from, if you arrest somebody, you read Miranda, you start already recording it. So you would find out if there's a false statement right there. Just wondering how this would play a part in it. But I will say I did have a conversation with the one testifier, and I appreciate his thoughts on the new science of all this, and it will be interesting to see how this goes. So thank you.
And I think it would be great for us to have the if we can, the free guide that you provide to law enforcement. Can you send us the link? And
absolutely.
Okay, great. Thank you. Representative Hollins, did look like you were wanting to respond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I and Representative Whitty in particular, I think what you're saying is when you have the recording of a false statement, but the reality is they can still take that confession that somebody makes, even if it's based on a false statement, and use that in a proceeding. And so what this bill would do is make it so that they can't use that unless they can prove preponderance of the evidence that the admission was voluntary, reliable, and not induced by a false statement. So yes, it would be recorded, but right now, currently, even if it's recorded and you know that law enforcement used a false statement, they can still use that confession in a court case. And to Representative Pinto's point, it does make the case harder to win because there's some question as to why somebody would confess to something when someone's lying to them.
All right, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hollins, for bringing this bill, and thank you to the testifiers. And Chief Potts, I have a question for you, so I'm glad you didn't leave that chair. Hope it's not too hot. I know it's not for you. The question I have, you've mentioned that you don't dispute the science that Mr. Fallon noted. Is there, but you said you're following it and you're watching it, that you all are. At what point would that science be ripe enough for you to say, yep, you know what, it's time to move in this direction?
Chief Potts.
Madam Chair, Representative Frazier, that's a good question. I can tell you that I don't know. I don't think we're there right now. Is this the first year the bill was heard and we kind of started looking at it this year?
Heard it in the Senate last year.
I've had conversations with the gentleman behind me and the information that he's offered to share with you, he's offered to share with us. I'll say again, we've had conversations about this bill and how I think there's probably more agreement on this at the level of a juvenile interrogation, at least at this point in time, based on a variety of different factors. And I think some of these we've already had conversations with you and the chair about. I don't know that my members, again, I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police, feel that we're there from a science standpoint for all cases. There are guardrails, scales has been mentioned, and other processes to ensure or at least attempt to ensure that that interrogations are fair and that we're not accepting, false confessions. I think we're on the same page that we want to try and do as much as we possibly can to eliminate that from happening. I'm not so sure that this is the only way to do that from a science standpoint at this point.
Thank you.
Representative Fish, okay. Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just listening to the conversation in here, and I'm thinking, okay, is this something that is really needed at this point in our state? Because you don't get a case prosecuted just on a statement or a piece of that statement. It's the totality of the case. Am I wrong? You got to have more than just one thing to keep that case moving forward to prosecution. And to know to Chief Potts' point there. Where is that line in here, that clear line that says you know, how much of this statement is going to be admissible, inadmissible now, is the rest of the evidence that was gathered through that statement in different questions during that statement, is that going to be admissible? Or is the whole statement, even though there was only one piece lie told or asked quite in a question, or is the whole statement going to be in the toilet then? So that's, I think that's something that should be fleshed out here, so that where's the line at, so that it's very clear that when you're taking a statement or you're doing an interview, that if I make one mistake in this interview, but I ask several questions during this interview, that the whole thing's gone. You know, and that's I think that's something that would be very important to get fleshed out, to make sure that it's clear.
Yeah, and I think that's a good question. I don't know if the bill author or testifier wants to address it. I mean, I assume that it's like if a statement is held to be involuntary, that maybe the parts up until that point, or somebody then invokes their right to counsel, things up until that point, but would be admissible. That was my assumption, but I do think it's a good question. It would be great if we could get some clarity on that. Mr. Marquardt.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you for the question, Representative Grossel. I think a couple points. I think that interpretation that the chair just offered is likely how a court would address it, to the extent there is sort of an untainted portion of the interview prior to the use of the methods that are being forbidden here. I think part of what of your concerns are I think animate the rebuttable presumption here, to be able to show that, you know, notwithstanding a sort of technical violation, we can you would have the opportunity, you being the state, would have the opportunity to demonstrate that it should be admissible anyway, because we can have confidence that it was voluntary, reliable, and not induced by the deceptive technique. So I think someone described that as a fail-safe. I mean, I think that is meant to pick up scenarios like that, where it's really more of a foot fault, so to speak, and doesn't really infect the reliability of the statement.
Anything further, Representative Grossel? Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, you know, it's kind of talking around, where is that line at? You know, let's work with the stakeholders, if you'd be so kind, and to where's that point at, to where, all right, let's make sure that if we're going to put this tool to use out here, that it's something that can be used. It's not going to put somebody away that which shouldn't. I mean, that's or set somebody free that, you know, dang well they should be sitting in a cell. Okay, so I want to make sure that we're not getting false confessions and so on. But I want to make sure that we have a tool for our law enforcement community to use, where they know where the line is drawn. Okay, so if it's something that can be used, then please, another tool.
Well, and I would say the stakeholders have been very willing to engage on the language on this bill, so maybe that is something that they could explore. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins. As I'm listening to this, I'm just kind of kicking around some questions in my head, and the hypotheticals pop up, right? An interaction where an interviewer brings somebody in, and maybe there's a co-conspirator, and they're sitting in different rooms, and you're asking them, okay, well, he told us everything, now tell us what you know. He's already told us everything.
Right.
That's deceptive. Yep. It's not true. But it's a super simple and easy tactic to get to the heart of the truth. And would that be banned under this current law?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Ingen. Yes, my understanding is that is exactly what we are trying to ban. Not the usage of that, but any confessions that are obtained therein, unless you can prove that it was voluntary, reliable, and not induced.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does nobody else see issue with this? That seems like a really straightforward way to get to the truth.
So I think what you're saying is the person is the officer interviewing suspect A is saying suspect B just told us everything, but actually suspect B didn't tell them everything.
Yeah.
That's a lie, and I think that's the kind of information that can induce these false confessions that our experts have talked about. Go ahead, Mr. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, and thank you for the questions, Representative Mingle. I think the devil's a little bit in the details here, too. I mean, the way the questions or statements from the officer are framed can make a really big difference. And even under existing case law, experienced officers know how to frame their statements in ways that aren't going to trip up legal wires. So, I mean, for example, right now, we cover this in this bill, too. It hasn't been as much of the discussion, but, you know, false representations about unauthorized offers of leniency. You know, officers know how to work around that and not make those promises, not to trip those wires, but to, you know, to encourage people to think about what the consequences might be of cooperation versus non-cooperation. There are skillful ways to do this that don't involve telling lies to people, and I think officers will be able to deploy those effectively and know where the lines are.
Anything further? All right. We do. I kind of got us off track. We moved way out of order. So Representative Hudson, we'll finish with you, and then we will move on. Go ahead.
Thank you for your indulgence, Madam Chair. And I wasn't planning to wade in on this, but Representative Engen tripped a wire in my brain. So let me just get this straight. So with this bill passing and being enacted into law, you could have a scenario like that which Representative Engen describes, where a confession is made. And I can understand on some level the idea that we're not going to have that confession itself be admissible. But perhaps the fact that they confessed leads to the discovery of other material evidence that indicates beyond reasonable doubt that the crime did in fact occur. Are we saying that the person can't be convicted in spite of the fact that we have evidence beyond reasonable doubt that they're guilty because a confession resulted from a lie?
Representative Collins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hudson. So my understanding is no. I mean, if you can find material evidence based on the confession, if they say, oh yeah, you know what, we did do this and we were wearing such and such gloves and we threw them over the fence and but we had to run for it, then you go and do your investigation, you find those gloves and you're like, okay, there we go, there's DNA proof, you know, we've got all this stuff, and that's absolutely allowed. So I don't want to say handcuffing, that's not let me think of a better phrase. It's not tying the hands of officers to be able to do their job. Simply, and any evidence that they can gain from that confession, if it is real, you know, but if somebody gives a false confession and says, we did all this stuff, and you go back and look and it turns out there's nothing there, well, then there's no evidence tying them to that situation. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hollins. It does make sense and it provides immense comfort. Thank you.
All right. Closing remarks. Oh, did you have? Okay. So go ahead. We did go way out of order. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Just real briefly, and I think it was the late night session last year when I used the same line. I'm not licensed to practice law in the state of Minnesota or any other state, but to answer the question, I think that would be what they call the poisonous tree. So that is what my fear is of this bill, this bill will be used to throw out what could be considered good confessions. The attack will be on the knowingly provided false information. I just want to be clear. I've never agreed with the Cup decision. I thought the Cup was wrong. We should be honorable. And I would never endorse anyone using a false statement to coerce or deceptively get a confession. My worry, and this bill is a lot better than it was when it first dropped, my worry is that this bill will just be another thing to get good work done unintentionally misleading or, you know, something that you thought was true but wasn't true. And I get that there's a safeguard in here, but it's just going to be the public defender's dream. So that's my feeling. Thank you for indulging me, Chair.
Closing remark. You can leave, Chief Potts. Sorry. Thank you. Thanks for your patience. Closing remarks, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members. I really appreciate this discussion. I'm going to take some of what you all have said and bring it back to the stakeholders and try to work out some of the details on this. But I appreciate the respectful discussion. I also appreciate Chief Potts being willing to sit in the hot seat for a little while, even though he was not planning on being there. And I want to thank my testifiers, one of whom has flown out from Georgia. So thank you so much, and I hope you can support the bill.
Thank you so much. Yes, thank you to the testifiers and to Chief Potts for coming down here. We appreciate it. Representative Hollins renews the motion that House File 2319 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. All right. Thanks, members, for that discussion. That was fascinating. We used a lot of our time, but it was a really good and helpful discussion. Next, we have House File 4657, Representative Curran's bill. Representative Curran, I believe your motion is that House File 4657 be placed on the General Register. Is that correct?
Yes, Chair, that is my motion. Thank you.
All right. And you also have the A1 amendment. Would you like to move and explain the A1 amendment, please?
Yes, I move the A1 amendment, which it changes dates simply because the Senate companion dropped last session, so we needed to update the dates there. This amendment also removes the section regarding manslaughter, and that's as a result of conversations that we've had as we've worked on the bill.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Please tell us about your bill as amended.
All right. Thank you so much, Chair and committee members, for hearing House File 4657 today. I will be very brief in my intro so we have time for our testifiers. This is a bill that would make it so that we can't use a panic defense in court. So an example would be someone was harmed or murdered, and it came out that the reason for that was that someone was afraid of them because of their sexual orientation or identity. We just want to make sure that there's no place for that defense in the courtroom, and that is the goal of this bill.
All right, very good. And then you have a couple of testifiers that I see. We've got Mara Saibesma. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, so come on down. And then on deck we have Carlton Laster, so please come on down as well. And then when I say that you're on deck, if you can go ahead and move down, that helps us keep things moving. So welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Well, thank you to Chair Mueller and to the members of the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee for the opportunity to present this testimony in support of HF 4657. My name is Mara Siusma. I understand it's a weird last name. It's weird in Dutch. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Lavender Bar Association, which is the primary association of attorneys in Minnesota that support our LGBTQ community. I'm also speaking on behalf of the National LGBTQ Bar Association. And like Representative Curran said, there's a lot of people speaking, so I'll keep it brief. HF 4657 is a bill that seeks to ban the gay panic or the trans panic defense. And what this defense is, it's a legal strategy in criminal cases that asks a jury to blame the victim's sexual orientation or their gender identity for the defendant's actions. The strategy tells juries that violence is justified against victims who are gay or transgender, and it implies that the event of discovering a victim's identity is so shocking in the moment that it justifies violence. It asks juries to accept this narrative, to reduce charges, or evade guilty verdicts altogether. In 2013, the American Bar Association unanimously approved a resolution urging state governments to limit the availability of this defense. Currently, 18 states have banned the defense, and the legislation is currently pending in four more states. And today, We urge this committee and this legislature to do the same. HF 4657 is a vital piece of legislation. Specifically, banning the gay and trans panic defense is necessary to make sure that arguments like this that justify targeted violence hold no weight in court. And passing this bill would send a clear message that LGBTQ people are safe in Minnesota and that violence that is fueled by bigotry is not tolerated. We urge the committee to support this legislation and to join other states in eliminating the defense. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for your testimony. My apologies on the mispronunciation of your name. Next, we have Carlton Laster, and then we have Myrtle Lemon Todd on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, and good evening. Hello, Chair Mueller and committee members. My name is Carlton Laster, and I'm the Director of Policy and Organizing for Outfront Minnesota, the state's largest LGBTQ plus advocacy organization. And in this role, I am privileged to advocate and push for policies that benefit Minnesota's LGBTQ plus community and address disparities. Today, I'm speaking in favor of HF 4657, the Panic Defense Bill. So-called panic defenses are not one single approach, but a series of strategies where a defendant charged with violent crimes may seek to weaponize their victim's sexual orientation or gender identity / expression to reduce or evade criminal liability. Discussion around this issue became part of the national conversation in 1999 during the Matthew Shepard murder trial, and recently in 2015 with the murder of Daniel Spencer. LGBTQ plus panic defense bans have passed in 17 states, including the District of Columbia, and they are supported by the American Bar Association, the Lavender Bar, and many other groups. Minnesota, like other states, has considered legislation to address this in past sessions. Renewed community calls to address this issue came after the tragic murder of Savannah Ryan Williams, a BIPOC trans woman, in Minneapolis this past November. Bias-motivated crimes against LGBTQ plus individuals are on the rise across the country, with a 13.8% increase in reports based on sexual orientation and a shocking 32.9% jump in reported hate crimes based on gender identity, according to data from the FBI's annual crime report. And these statistics reflect the lived realities of LGBTQ plus community who are experiencing threats of discrimination and violence all too frequently. On a personal level, I myself have had close personal friends impacted by this violence, and so enough is enough. While addressing the so-called panic defenses is only one step in addressing safety concerns, it sends an important message to the LGBTQ plus and BIPOC Minnesotans that our lives and existence in fact matter. All Minnesotans deserve safety and protection to exist freely under the law, and for LGBTQ plus Minnesotans, the passage of HF 4657 is a step forward in better protecting our state's LGBTQ plus communities from harms of transphobia and homophobia. Let's honor the memory of those we've lost and ensure that Minnesota sends a clear message of support for LGBTQ plus communities across the state. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We've got Myrtle Lemon Todd and then Amber Muhn up. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hello, committee members and chair. Thank you so much for having me here tonight. My name is Myrtle Lemon Todd. My pronouns are they, them, or he, him. I'm an activist, a nonprofit youth worker, and a proud member of the Minnesota trans community. I am testifying today to urge you to support HF 4657, a crucial piece of legislation aimed at limiting what is known colloquially as the 2S LGBTQIA plus panic defense in this great state of Minnesota. This defense is an outdated and discriminatory legal strategy that allows individuals accused of violent crimes against queer and trans individuals to justify their actions and seek lesser sentencing therein by claiming a panic or a provoking of the victim's gender identity or expression. I would be remiss today if I didn't acknowledge a pertinent case to our discussion. Gwen Arroyo, a 17-year-old transgender teenager in California, was murdered on October 3rd, 2002.
Two of the defendants were convicted of second-degree murder but not requested hate crime enhancements to the charges. The other two defendants pleaded guilty or no contest to voluntary manslaughter, but at both of these trials, the trans panic defense, an extension of this panic defense, was employed. Resultant of this case, California became the first state in the nation to prohibit the use of this panic defense in 2014, 12 years after Gwen's murder. California is now one of 17 states that have already passed legislation outlawing this defense, and Minnesota must be next. Supporting this bill aligns with the principles of fairness and equality that are fundamental to our state of Minnesota as a whole. With the 2003 U.S. Transgender Survey reporting 10% of respondents who have moved out of their state because of discrimination, and another 40% debating moving, Minnesota must stand proud in its victory of trans refuge, and it is the responsibility of our legislators to uphold such principles and justice and equality for all. I urge you to stand on the right side of history and support HF 4657 and work towards its swift passage into law. Thank you so much today.
Thanks for your testimony. Amber, and I don't know if it's how to pronounce your last name, so come. Amber Mum, come on up, come forward, and then introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony. And Pierce Hastings, you're on deck.
All right.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. And thank you, Representative Curran, for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Amber Mum. I work at the Aliveness Project as an HIV outreach and prevention specialist, a trans community specialist, and as a co-lead of our trans feminine support group, Tea Time. And I'm a proud transgender woman and mother of two trans kids here today in support of HF 4657. Our country is currently experiencing a terrifying increase in anti-LGBTQ+ and specifically anti-transgender violence, which is what my testimony will focus on. According to data from the Human Rights Campaign, at least 335 trans and gender nonconforming people since 2013 have been documented as victims of fatal violence in the United States, with a staggering 51% or 171 of those deaths occurring in the past 4 years. Trans women of color are particularly targeted, comprising 85% of the 10-year case total, with 69% occurring against black trans women specifically. The HRC has classified these as a, quote, epidemic of violence and asserts that this number is likely much, much higher. A study by UCLA's Williams Institute found that transgender people are four times more likely to experience violent victimization when compared to cisgender people. This is sadly a local issue. In Minnesota last year, we had three high-profile cases of anti-trans violence, resulting in a mass shooting, two deaths, and a ripple effect of fear throughout the local trans community. As transgender Minnesotans, we know that the trans panic defense is still legal in our state and that it can potentially be used by our killers to evade justice and further disrespect our dead. According to the Williams Institute study I referenced earlier, the LGBTQ plus panic defense has been used 104 times in 35 states since the 1960s, resulting in 33% of cases having charges reduced. For decades, we have been subject to this abhorrent victim blaming, with courts allowing our assaulters and murderers to weaponize our gender identities and sexual orientations to avoid the full consequences of the harm they cause us. This is not a hypothetical legal debate. Trans panic defenses are a known and effective legal strategy, and unless we act now, they will continue to be used against us. Despite our state's history of LGBTQ plus legislative victories, there is one glaring omission. Out of the 12 states that have passed trans refuge laws, only two have not also banned the trans panic defense, Maryland and Minnesota. As a trans woman and community organizer, this is insulting, infuriating, and frankly unacceptable. How can we call ourselves a refuge state for trans folks if such an obvious inequity of justice is still possible? How is it that in the 25 years since Matthew Shepard's horrific murder, we are still having this debate? Why is our mere existence so, quote, controversial that we are denied basic legal equity, even in death? How many of us have to be slaughtered in cold blood, our bodies left to rot on alleyway concrete before we take action and address this issue? How many grieving families have to be further traumatized in needlessly drawn out legal proceedings? Enough is enough. Trans panic defenses are a barbaric misuse of our legal system, further stigmatizing an already vulnerable minority population and perpetuating violent queerphobic, transphobic, and transmisogynistic rhetoric. Trans refuge needs to be an ongoing commitment, a continued effort to ensure that those who come within our borders seeking safety and support receive it. Minnesotans, both lifelong and newly welcomed, deserve better than this. HF 4657 is critical civil rights legislation and deserves to move forward. The trans community is watching.
Thanks for your testimony. And then the final testifier is Pierce Hastings. And after you, we will move on to member discussion. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good evening. My name is Pierce Hastings, and my pronouns are she, her. Tonight, I want to speak about my personal experience moving through the world as a trans woman. I'm 24 years old, and I've spent the last 3 years medically and socially transitioning. Since I first started presenting more feminine, I have faced dozens of experiences where I feared for my safety on account of my transness. In many cases, men aggressively flirted with me on the street before realizing that I was trans, then when they realized, threatened violence. Imagine all the sexual harassment cis women go through on the street with a heightened fear that your life may be on the line, and statistically way more of those scenarios. And I'm a white woman. Things get even more dangerous for our Black and Indigenous trans sisters. 50% of the trans people murdered in 2023 were Black transgender women, and Native women at large are murdered at 10 times the national average. It's no secret that trans women live in a near constant state and fear of violence, not just from strangers, but also from the legal system. Tonight, you have the opportunity to ban a defense that fundamentally dehumanizes trans people by saying their very existence can excuse violence towards them. That's like saying it's legally defensible for someone to kill a ginger just because discovering the color of the victim's hair color drove them into a state of delirium. Trans people's transness does not beget violence. And while you personally might not be able to prevent that violence itself, at the very least tonight, you can prevent the excuse that our transness makes the violence justified, or that we had it coming. In the worst case scenario, you can prevent someone inundated with anti-trans rhetoric online and in the news from encountering a trans person in public and acting on their wildest, most violent fantasies, knowing that the trans panic defense could maybe exonerate them in the future. You have a responsibility to prevent someone from murdering a trans person because they think they might get away with it. On another note, not only is this bill important to prevent the trans panic defense from being used, it's also an important step for trans mental health. We need to believe we are human ourselves and deserve to live. 42% of trans people have attempted suicide at least once in their life because they don't believe it will ever get better and see nothing but a life of pain, exile, and danger ahead of them. Passing House File 4657 would be one step towards showing trans people that our lives have value and that people's violent reactions towards us are not our fault. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. We will move now to member discussion. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While I was reading over this bill, I really wanted to see what it would do in effect. And I couldn't help but wonder if in the course of a sexual interaction, someone discovers that the biological nature of their current sexual partner is not what they believed it to be, or what they were led to believe that allowed them to engage in that action consensually from the beginning. And that consent piece is huge. It appears that the bill provides an opportunity for criminal penalties to be imposed upon a victim who was misled, coerced, or otherwise tricked into believing that their partner was something that they believed it to be when it was not. Can you clarify that that concern for me?
Representative Karn.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Rep. Engen, for your question. First, I just want to note that we did strike the language regarding manslaughter, so there's nothing in this bill that would create an additional crime upon the discovery of someone's sexual orientation or identity. The other thing that I would highlight is in this scenario, the victim that we're talking about is the person who is harmed, physically harmed, and in several cases that we've talked about today, murdered. I really struggle to find any reason why it would be okay in that scenario to say, oh, there was information you didn't know, go ahead and kill that person. That's not acceptable, and we want to make sure that's not used in the courtroom. So that's why we're doing this bill.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd say that that's extremely inflammatory that I would insinuate that it has to do with murder. Murder is wrong in all cases. I think that it's wrong to engage in that act without there being an even playing field as to where people are standing. To know where someone is and what their gender is, what their biological or perceived gender, whatever it might be, there should be consent there. I feel like that's a very basic notion. We've all learned that no means no, right? And that consent demands there be an equal playing field between the two that are engaging in that act. I see that this could potentially impose crimes upon someone who is saying, no, this is not an act that I have consented to, once they discover that inequity. I'm going to ask again, can you speak to that portion?
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And I will invite one of our testifiers, Amber, to come up, because I think we've had this conversation before. But I again want to reiterate that what this bill aims to do is to prevent the use of defense in a courtroom when someone is harmed because of their identity. Now, the circumstances under which that happens, you could use that same argument for any sort of attribute of a person in general, that maybe you weren't certain that somebody was a certain religion and you found out later and that made you mad. Whatever the reason happens to be there, this specific bill is designed so that that defense cannot be used in a courtroom. And I'll turn it over to our testifier as well.
Yep. Amber, Mom, if you want to come forward here and answer that, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can say that as a trans woman, as a community organizer, as someone who works with several transgender women in particular, that hypothetical doesn't happen in real life, period. It does not. We are fully disclose our transgender status when we are dating, when we are entering interactions, out of safety. We would never try to trick anyone. We would never try to insinuate that we were anything other than transgender. And frankly, it is slightly insulting to insinuate that we are trying to trick anyone with our gender while we are dating. That is not something that happens in reality. I would love if there was a citation, if you could find an evidence of that happening, especially in Minnesota. But in my 2.5 years of community organizing, in my 37 years live on this earth, I have not seen that ever happen.
Final question, Representative Egan.
Well, if that's the case, if it truly never happens, it seems like we could easily pass a law that would demand that that be disclosed. If it's never happening, it seems like we found some common ground here. And to say that it's never happened, I have to cite a source as to where it has. Show me where it hasn't. I'm sure it has before. Hypotheticals are what we have to think about in law, because they have ramifications. There's trade-offs to policy here, and to not have that defense, and to not have that equal ground going into that what was a consensual act, which then they recognize was not consensual, we have to think about that. I'm sorry. That's where I stand on this. So,
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Thank you, Representative Curran, for bringing this bill. I'm trying really hard to focus on what I was going to say because I was very thrown off by the previous comments. So I'm going to try and focus on what I was going to say instead of replying to the other side. This is an important bill. And I know you know that I carried this bill back in my first year, and I am very excited to see it moving forward. I think I have a number of trans and queer friends, and I knew logically sort of what they experienced on a day-to-day basis, but actually my eyes have been opened even further now because the incredible Lee Finke is the other side of my district. And we share a district together. I share a district with a trans woman who I get tagged in photos with and who I go to town halls with and who I interact with in general. And the amount of vitriolic hate that I witness now that I am in those spaces, in those photos, in those social media posts is truly horrific. And honestly, frightening. And I cannot imagine walking this world fearing at all times that I might be the subject
of some sort of crime simply because of who I am. Like, that is, it's, I mean, theoretically it's real for me as, you know, as a queer brown person. Like, theoretically, yeah, that could happen. But I've never felt it as acutely as I have now, sharing an amazing space with my good friend, Representative Finke. And so I really thank you for bringing this, because this is a serious issue and it impacts a lot of people. And as we have worked hard to make Minnesota a trans refuge, we need to make sure that the folks who are coming here are protected in our legal system and don't have to fear for their lives. So thank you. I really appreciate it.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And sincerely, thank you, Representative Curran, for raising this topic. I want to take this slow. I know we've got another bill, but I want to take it slow for a couple of reasons. One, because I know it's a deeply personal and sensitive issue that evokes intense emotions, but also because I think there are some really important legal considerations that need to be fleshed out. So I'm going to start with the necessity for this bill under current law. So our nonpartisan summary of this bill acknowledges the fact that the gay panic defense exists. It's a thing. But it goes on to say, in Minnesota, the state Supreme Court addressed the issue in a 1980 decision, State versus Morgan. In that case, the defendant argued he reasonably believed Mac was about to commit the offense of sodomy against him and that he was therefore justified in shooting Mac in resisting the offense. So there's your gay panic defense. The next sentence, the court rejected that defense. Minnesota law makes an assault motivated by other person's sexuality a more serious offense under section 609.2231 and 609.2233. It occurs to me, first and foremost, that assault is illegal, murder is illegal. We have passed laws in this state that enhance the penalty for those crimes if they're found to be motivated by bias based upon other things, including sexual identity, sexual orientation, and gender identity. What gap is your bill filling, Representative Curran?
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And Representative, to your question about what gap this is filling, you're right that this panic defense does exist. And for the trans community, that is the gap. That is the gap in protection. That is the gap when it comes to a courtroom that currently, as it stands in law, you know, we do have other cases where maybe it was decided that this was not an appropriate defense to use. And that's case law, right? That's not codification. That's not state law. So we already know that there are plenty of, you know, scenarios of case law and Supreme Court decisions that have been overturned over the years as well. This is a solid way to secure or to ban this defense from being used in the state of Minnesota. I would also add that one important piece of this is not just banning the defense, but by banning the defense, it eliminates the stage for further harmful rhetoric to a community, to even provide a platform to insinuate that people might be trying to trick others into behavior, that we're being deceptive, that the queer community is somehow violent or to be feared. We are taking that platform away. And that is also a really crucial piece of this bill.
Representative Hudson, one final.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so since it's got to be the final, I guess I got to go for the gusto here. It appears as though you're suggesting that it is not possible for a trans person to engage in deceptive behavior in an attempt to gain sexual access to another person.
I find that prima facie ridiculous. Any person is capable of engaging in deceptive behavior, regardless of whatever protected status they may have. I find it interesting that it was stated by your testifier that this never happens. There's never a situation where deception is utilized in order to gain sexual access to another person, and yet your bill addresses that circumstance directly. I mean, lines 3.8 through 3.13 that provides this new prohibition on defense. It says it is not a defense to a crime that the defendant acted based on the discovery of, knowledge about, or potential disclosure of the victim's actual or perceived sexual orientation, including gender identity expression, including under circumstances in which the victim made an unwanted, unforcible, which is an interesting word, I'll come back to that, romantic or sexual advance towards the defendant, or if the defendant and victim dated or had a romantic or sexual relationship, past tense. Why would we need to put that in the law if this never happens, if there's never a scenario where someone's gender identity or sexual orientation is discovered after a romantic or sexual relationship? That would be question one. And then secondarily, again, because I have to close here, are we unintentionally, because that word unforcible, unwanted, unforcible, romantic, or sexual advance, we recognize in law that one manifestation of force is fraud. If you present me with a value proposition in order to secure a transaction, and I agree to that transaction based upon the value proposition that was presented to me, and then I discover after the fact that the value proposition that was presented to me was incorrect, factually incorrect, that the value was not there, in commerce, we call that fraud. In sexual congress, we call that sexual assault. We call that abuse. And so it appears as though, intentional or not, and I want to assume it's unintentional, that this bill provides the mechanism through which, hypothetically, we could have a situation where someone who's in the process of being sexually assaulted via deceptive presentation of the value proposition to that interaction finds themselves unable to legally defend themselves against what at that point in the interaction becomes an unconsensual activity, that they would have to simply submit to having been deceived in order to gain sexual access to their body. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Kern.
Thank you, Chair. First, I just want to point out that in the state of Minnesota, as far as I'm aware, that any sexual encounter that has value or transaction is already illegal. Just put that to bed right there. And as to, you know, you had mentioned a few sections in the bill that fall under Section 4, I believe was referenced 3.18, et cetera. That was already removed from the bill in the amendment that we took up at the beginning of this bill. So I just... Again, that particular language has been stricken, but I will say that that you're right. That language is not necessary, and there's just because of the time and the limited staffing that we have, we weren't able to get an amendment to strike that specific language, but that is something that we do want to strike, and moving forward, we're hoping that our companion in the Senate or through final processes will be able to strike the language that you referenced.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I got to say, I'm pretty thrown by this as well, Representative Holland. So here's what I'll say. Violence, right, force is not fraud. Force is force. And the use of force is wrong when you're in a relationship with somebody. The paragraph here relating to that force... let me try to collect my thoughts here for a second. I'm understanding my GOP colleagues making the point that if there's some sort of deceptive relationship, that somehow force, that violence would be somehow justified, that force would be justified. And what this is saying is simply saying that you may not use force with the justification. That's the point of this, that you may not use force based on the discovery of, knowledge about, et cetera, of sexual orientation. So members, I guess I'm really confused here because there's a distinction. The reason that it says unwanted, non-forcible advance is the idea is that if there's not force involved, you may not bring force to be involved. Can't bring it in. And so if you have some issue in the relationship, if you feel that somebody in some way has been deceptive, let's say that in fact happens, are we saying that justifies the use of force, that somebody can be punched or can be kicked or can be killed? I certainly would hope not. So that is the distinction that's being made here. That in fact, the whole point of the bill is that any possibility somebody might consider that force could be justified in such a situation is not something that should be allowed. The very fact somebody might think, might possibly read this discussion as to be some sort supporting such a thing is, to my mind, the whole reason for the bill. And as I look, and I should say, I had some skepticism in thinking this through, and I realized, wait a second, whatever else the courts may have said at any point, we're at a point in our history as a country and as a state where there is a group of Minnesotans that are being targeted because of who they are. I mean, it just is true. We just know that it is. It's a particular group targeted based on their identity. And as I look at this and as I consider where the law is, I have to say I am not confident without the change that that group does not get targeted and harmed in the way that this bill is attempting to stop. We certainly know that it happens, right? And again, the idea that somehow deceptiveness in a sexual relationship where force is not involved would possibly justify the use of force, to my mind, is exactly why this is needed. I thank you, Representative Curran, and I thank your testifiers. I will say that as I heard the testimony and thought this through, I found this extremely helpful. So thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Tapke.
Thank you very much, Chair Mueller. I was going to say pretty much exactly what Representative Pinto just said there, and to reiterate, so A, thank you very much, Representative Curran, for bringing this and everybody who came and testified to talk about this today. It's something that needs to be talked about. And we must reiterate and say very, very clearly that force is not okay. It's just never okay, and we need to make sure that everyone hears that, that no matter what someone's reasoning is, whether they feel duped or whatever it may be, it's never okay. And we need to make sure that from this committee's perspective, from my perspective, that we are saying that. And so thank you for bringing this forward to make sure that we are reiterating that in state law, because it is evidently very, very necessary. So thank you.
All right, closing remarks, Representative Kern.
You know, thank you so much, Chair Mueller, for the hearing today. Thank you, members, for the robust discussion. I think that our testifiers have made it, excuse me, pretty clear about why we need to pass this bill. And I especially want to thank my colleagues who have expressed support for the bill. I often don't find myself so emotionally moved. And I do in this moment. So thank you for your support.
Representative Curran renews the motion that House File 4657, as amended, be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, and thanks to those who testified. The next bill on the calendar for the day is House File 3991, Vice Chair Feist. And Vice Chair Feist, I believe your motion is that House File 3991 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. And you're walking up to the testifier table, so we'll give you a second to get there. And is that your motion? It's going back to Judiciary?
I guess so. Yeah.
It's because of the fiscal note.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. All right, so your bill is before us. We have no amendments. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Committee. The goal of House File 3991 is to expand access to restorative restitution for youth and to address the counterproductive burden of fines and fees on children and families in the context of our juvenile justice system. Fines, fees, and monetary restitution obligations can drown youth and their families in debt and have lifelong consequences that follow young people into adulthood and impact their future opportunities. I appreciated the significant bipartisan participation in our virtual field trip to Yellow Medicine County's Restorative Justice Department during the interim. This visit highlighted the power of restorative justice to create meaningful accountability, address harm caused, and make our communities safer and our systems more just. The experts from Yellow Medicine County, as well as Ramsey County, contributed to the drafting of this legislation. This bill aims to enhance access to meaningful accountability mechanisms and to eliminate counterproductive mechanisms in law by doing the following. It encourages the use of restorative processes to satisfy restitution obligation where available. It permits the use of restorative practices grants that we created in 2023 for the purposes of obtaining monetary compensation to satisfy restitution obligations of a child who participates in a restorative process to address harm. And it eliminates several fines and fees in the juvenile justice context. Notably, these fines are not ordered or collected at levels that would have meaningful impact on court revenues, and we do actually have now an actual fiscal note. To proactively answer a few questions that have arisen, these changes do not replace monetary restitution where it is applicable. These changes will simply provide more avenues for non-monetary restitution and sources of payment so that the young person can earn the ability to pay off the restitution. If a young person is given the opportunity for restorative restitution and they simply fail to meet those requirements, the county attorney would have the ability to revert back to a traditional process. And lastly, I was asked about data, and I love data. There is robust data at the county level that tracks outcomes of youth who engage in restorative practices. Yellow Medicine County has 22 years of data on every child's outcomes and whether and how they satisfied the needs of the victim. In addition, the state court system tracks all restitution payments, as do counties, so we will be able to track the impact of restorative restitution where it is utilized. Lastly, our new Office of Restorative Practices has been tasked with collecting and sharing data, and data collection is required for all restorative practice grants recipients. This bill has many objectives. This bill has many objectives. It aims to enhance public safety by facilitating a type of accountability that ensures that young people truly understand the impact of their behavior on the victim. It aims to expand opportunities for the child themselves to account for the damage they caused through their own actions rather than a parent. And lastly, it aims to expand opportunities for a child to engage in restorative restitution that ultimately enhances their positive self-image and sense of connection with their community, which will reduce recidivism. And now I will turn it over to my amazing testifiers who can make these high-level goals into concrete examples for the committee.
All right, thank you. And in the interest of time, we'll call everybody down right now. We've got Jessica Jeppesen, Sheena Lee, and Morgan Coons. So, Jessica, you're on my list first, so I think you're up first.
Yeah, and Sheena couldn't make it, unfortunately.
Oh, Sheena's not here. Okay.
But she was, like, part of Jeffy's.
All right. All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. I am Jessie Jepson from Yellow Medicine County. I have been a circle facilitator for 12 years, and Sheena couldn't be here with me tonight. I know some of you heard her last week Friday, and she spoke to being a single mom of five, and something came up, and she needed to be there. But I will tell you a little bit about her case. So like I said, I'm a circle facilitator. For those of you who may not know exactly what that is, it's a restorative process in which we bring together the person who created harm, those who the harm happened to, any other community members who may be affected, and then our volunteers who've been trained in the circle process and a facilitator. So I met Sheena and her sons back in 2018 when they had thrown rocks at a vehicle they believed to be abandoned out behind the trailer park, which happened to not be. It was left there for harvest work, and so when it was found by the owner, it had significant damage, and so they were brought into the court system for this damage to property and then sent to circle sentencing by our county attorney. And so when they came into circle, one of the things that we always look towards is what restitution needs to take place in different community service hours. When you talked about data, we've never had a case in the 22 years that we haven't made sure the restitution is taken care of. Anyways, in this situation, it was a little bit complicated because her sons were 9 and 11, okay, and they're not old enough to work. This man did not have insurance on the pickup because of it not being in service at that time or not being used at that time. So he had taken it somewhere to look and see, and it was somewhere over $5,000 that was wanted. So we had to kind of figure out what to do. We ended up being able to get the victim, if you will, to talk with us over the phone. He was not willing to come to Circle because he was a little angry at the children who had caused this issue to happen at the time. So together with our Circle members and him on the phone and the parents, we came up, or with mom, we came up with the agreement of $1,800 because that's what the Kelley Blue Book value of the vehicle was if it was in good working condition. So the children then, one of our volunteers actually anonymously paid him the $1,800, and then the kids worked to pay her back, but they didn't know it was her. But anyways, so they set up a detailing business and were detailing vehicles for people for $20. And so in the end, they cleaned the inside of 45 vehicles to take care of that $900 of theirs, because there was two other individuals who weren't in Circle. So I just wanted to speak to that. That's kind of how we went towards this in a different creative fashion to take care of that restitution. And in the end, we had invited the victim to come back to Circle to be able to talk with the youth about what happened. But he had said that after being a part of the conversation and being included in it, he wasn't angry anymore, and he understood that this happened and they're just kids who made a mistake. So he chose to not come and participate in that and just let them know that he was thankful that it had been taken care of.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for sharing that story. Thanks for coming here to be with us. Morgan, come on forward, introduce yourself, and you can begin your testimony. Morgan and I used to work together, so we're on a first-name basis.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and distinguished members. I am Morgan Coons, the managing attorney of the Youth Prosecution Division in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. Allowing youth to repay their restitution obligations while engaging in restorative practices just makes common sense. So I'm going to focus on the second part of the bill, which talks about refocusing accountability for youth away from fines and towards more effective interventions. Fines are already uncommon in the juvenile justice system. Multiple counties around the state do not use fines for juveniles as it currently stands. The reason that counties have gone in that direction is because fines are not effective at restoring victims, they're not effective at reducing recidivism, and they don't provide meaningful accountability to youth. Courts have a long list of more effective means at intervening in youth besides fines. Examples of this include probation supervision, programming for ordering mentoring, anger management, defensive driving courses, mental health or chemical dependency courses, group therapy, job training, career development, a long list of actions that a court can take to get a child to not recidivate. Restorative justice programs and diversion programs are other examples. Courts can order youth to attend school, to follow rules at home. Courts can order youth to do community service, to engage in, to write a reflection essay, to write a letter of apology. All of these types of interventions are much more effective than fines. The data in Hennepin County shows that youth who successfully complete restorative justice programs are less likely to recidivate than their peers who do not. This is supported by the national data. This is supported by all of the academic research in the area of juvenile justice. This bill moves Minnesota in the right direction. It helps victims by increasing the likelihood they will receive restitution, and it helps juvenile offenders by holding them accountable to their families, to their communities, and to the victims, not to monetary fines. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your testimony. And I don't think you had any other testifiers. All right, so we can move on to member discussion. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Feist. As a teacher for a million years, I understand how important this is. And of course, this was something that I tried to model as much as I could in my classroom. I did just have a couple of question about the language that is on the very last page. Because I believe that as we're looking at this, you know, the idea of restorative practices is, you know, per your testifier, it's a lot harder. It's a lot harder than simply paying a fine and goes through a lot of, you know, soul searching, which is really important. Like, I'm all for that. I think it's really important. This language here, though, on this last page, where the Office of Restorative Practices, basically the state, can provide grants for, or that basically provides money that's just going to pay the fines. And while I don't agree that paying fines by themselves is going to bring restoration. I really liked your first testifier that talked about how, you know, they did a job or did something to earn that money to pay that fine that also had that restorative practice. And so I didn't know if there was some comfort language we could put in here that would say, hey, okay, on the offset, maybe the state is paying for this, but we would like to see this, you know, reimbursed or refunded through restorative practices somehow. Hopefully I'm making sense. And if you could just talk a little bit more to that, that'd be great.
Yeah. Vice Chair Feist. So what you're describing is exactly what we intended, and we've actually been having many emails to make that more clear. But what you're describing is exactly what we intend with this language. We want to facilitate exactly the type of restorative restitution process that Ms. Jefferson described. Fantastic. And we're going to make that a lot more clear.
Feels good for me. All right. Anyone else? All right, closing remarks.
I'm really excited about this bill. It does something small that I think will have a really big impact. I would urge your support. Thank you.
All right, Vice Chair Feist renews the motion that House File 3991 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thanks again, and thanks for the drive here from Yellow Medicine continually. We appreciate it. Safe travels home. All right, next up we have House File 1832. It's a Representative Frazier bill. I will move to lay, or actually, Representative Frazier, is your motion to lay over House File 1832?
Yes.
All right. And then would you like to move the DE4 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. And because the DE4 is a complete change to the bill, I think it makes it more sense for us to just adopt the amendment and then you can talk about the bill. Is that
all
right?
That's fair. And I will be addressing that. There's a D3 amendment that I'm not moving that I'll talk about as well.
All right. And then there is an A1 amendment to the DE4 that we also have to do, which my understanding is that is just a technical amendment. So anybody have any comments on the A1 amendment? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. And now would you like to move the DE4 amendment as amended?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
All right. Any discussion to that? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails, and the DE4 amendment as amended is adopted. Now your bill as amended is before us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with it amended, what this does is provide for peace officers when they are pulling individuals over under Section 169.84 for secondary offenses, they will be required to inform that individual of the reason why they pulled them over. Currently, many of you may have experienced this if you've ever been pulled over for a traffic citation, an officer may ask you, do you know why I pulled you over? Which then leads into a conversation. What we're trying to do is decrease interactions that may be heightened or increased that may lead to further interactions that, from what we've seen in our state in recent years, could lead to very volatile and violent interactions, which could lead to further distrust among law enforcement and communities. So we're seeking to address that with just a simple, this is why I pulled you over. Hopefully it can be a quick exchange, and then folks can move on with their day. This bill also provides for a work group to be put together to address the expired tabs and how to still achieve the payment portions for that. We also are looking to seek, and I'll talk more about this in D3 that I'm not moving, we're looking for a way to remove that out of the enforcement mechanism for peace officers. It is something that we believe can be done in a civil structure, and we've been working with DPS, State Patrol, and also the DMV to figure out a way to have that process work. So the work group or the task force will work and provide recommendations on how we can do that moving forward.
All right, great. And would you like to move to testifiers, or do you want to explain the DE3 first? What's your preference?
Yeah, let me talk about the DE3, okay, because I think testifiers will be speaking to that DE3. So the DE3, which I am not moving, is work that we have done in a comprehensive manner, but there's still work to be done, which is why we're not moving it tonight. And I want to thank you, Chair Moeller, The DE3 is an idea that came about. First of all, we have to go back to April of 2021. In April of 2021, we were the exact date here. On April 11th of 2021, we were 9 days away from the verdict of the Derek Chauvin trial, who was eventually convicted of the murder of George Floyd. But on that day, on April 11th, we then learned of the killing of Dante Wright. And I mention that because this bill was born out of, and the work that we've done up to this point, we're not quite there yet to get it across the finish line, this idea of how do we prevent interactions such as that. Dante Wright was pulled over. There were two reasons. One was tabs, the other was a, from what I understand in this case, the details, he had an angel hanging from the rearview mirror, and he was pulled over for those particular reasons, not particularly safety reasons, but pulled over for potential citation, and then we all know the escalation that led to the shooting of Dante Wright. We are trying to figure out a way to prevent those situations from happening. They do not build trust in the community. It further erodes and creates more distance and separation between the community and law enforcement, and we are seeking for ways to address that issue to prevent those situations from happening. That was a very trying time for that community and for all of Minnesota, because we were still very much dealing with the grieving and dealing with the trauma of what happened to Mr. Floyd in that period of time. So the DE3, which is not being moved, was a comprehensive look at the statute that deals with traffic offenses, and how do we codify and incorporate by modifying and modernizing that statute to look at secondary offenses and remove some of those offenses from reasons to be pulled over and cited by peace officers. I think we've been doing a very good job of trying that. We have been engaging stakeholders for months on this. And again, I want to thank Chair Moeller, because during that time in April of 2021, it was Chair Moeller who reached out and said, I've been working on this situation. I think this is a good moment to have this conversation and talk about ways we can limit or lower these interactions that raise to a level that can be very harmful to the individual driver, the officer engaged, and then ultimately the community when those tragic situations happen. So the D3 was an extensive approach to do that. We do have more work to do, because I just the other day got an email from the Department of Transportation addressing some issues that we may need to take a look at to ensure that we're not capturing things that shouldn't be captured in terms of safety issues with some of our commercial vehicles. So with that, I will take a step back, yield, and let the testifiers testify to the bill.
All right, great. The only one I have on the list is Amber Jones, but I don't know if anybody else from the public wanted to testify. And so if so, if you wanted to come down and have a seat, that would be great. All right, Amber, it looks like it's just you. Introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
All right. Well, thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Amber Jones. I work at the African American Leadership Forum, leading our policy work. And I am also testifying today in my capacity as a steering committee member for the Justice for All Coalition. The Justice for All Coalition is a collective of 50-plus advocates, defendants, lawyers, social workers, leaders, and those who have firsthand experience with the criminal legal system, pressing for or resisting reforms to seek meaningful legal systems transformations that protect public safety while addressing and transforming those parts of the system that do more harm than good. And we are here today to really stand in support. We want to commend Representative Frazier, Chair Mueller, Representative Feist, and other members of this committee in previous sessions to advance amending pre-sex laws. But we also want to really encourage and really hold this committee accountable to making sure that we can make substantive actions on this bill this session. As the author of this bill noted, we have been debating this issue for several years now. And in 2021, when this bill actually came to the floor, The House decides to keep it in this omnibus package to really send a strong signal that we're ready to take action. And so we want to lift that up here 3 years later and really call on the House to take action on this bill, take action on this amendment here tonight. We really want to lift up the issue here, really talking about the disproportionality when it comes to low-level traffic stops and how it particularly impacts Black and brown drivers. Data from communities who have restricted traffic stops for secondary offenses have demonstrated that law enforcement agencies can actually achieve better public safety outcomes by focusing on more serious crimes. Officers can enhance their effectiveness and improve overall safety on our roads by directing their attention to violations directly linked to road safety, such as speeding and driving under the influence. And so we really urge the committee to amend low-level traffic laws to address these issues swiftly. As we've seen, particularly in Ramsey County, as they have taken such leadership to address this issue, they've been able to decrease their traffic stops by 86% and their searches by 92% and been able to demonstrate that there has been no change in the contraband yield rate. So particularly to the DE4 amendment that is going to be debated here tonight, we do support its expanded, its expansive nature. Traffic stops often serve as the first point of contact between law enforcement and the public, carrying significant risk. Curbing the use of pretextual stops has the potential to reduce racial disparities in policing, optimize the allocation of law enforcement resources, and better build better, more trusting relationships between communities and law enforcement agencies. So the Justice for All Coalition believes that House File 1832 represents a critical opportunity to advance racial equity and justice in policing. There is still ample time to amend this law and end low-level traffic stops, and the coalition is ready to assist. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for your testimony. We'll move on now to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Frazier. It seems to me that there's a missing piece from consideration here. I understand the desire to not see members of the community cut down as a result of officer-involved shootings. That's a rational desire. I think there are ways to get there that probably address the root of what causes those scenarios better than this bill. It's stated by your testifier, this is one of the primary points of contact or primary ways in which law enforcement engages with the community. A law has been violated, and the person who's doing so is endangering the public by driving a vehicle that's not street legal, not safe to be in operation. And often it's discovered, as was the case with Dante Wright, that they have an outstanding arrest warrant. In his case, it was misdemeanor charges involving illegal possession of a pistol. We spent a lot of time talking about how we want to reduce gun violence. It occurs to me that one of the best ways to do that is to apprehend somebody who has an outstanding warrant for illegal possession of a pistol. And so I guess I'm wondering, like, if we're taking away the primary mechanism by which law enforcement engages with the public, what's the alternative process through which such warrants are going to be executed?
Representative Frazier.
Representative Hudson, in that scenario that you just described, they weren't there to, the initial onset wasn't to serve a warrant. This bill doesn't touch any ability that a prosecutor would have to seek a warrant and then have that warrant executed by a sheriff or a local police officer. So this doesn't touch that at all, and I think that is the way that those things should be addressed.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Frazier. So you're suggesting that the way to respond to someone having a warrant out for their arrest is to track them down in some other fashion other than finding them as the result of a traffic stop.
Representative Frazier.
What I'm saying is that this bill does not curtail the ability to serve someone a warrant. Just the initial reason that they pulled Mr. Wright over was not to serve a warrant. And we see where the escalation led to. We lost a life, and we further created a further gulf of distrust between law enforcement and community. That is what we're seeking to address here, is how do we prevent those situations. And these are about low-level traffic offenses, not situations where you're driving a vehicle that would be harmful to yourself or to the community because you're operating that vehicle. The approach that we're taking is very scalpel-like to ensure that that is not the case. If it is truly a public safety hazard to be driving that vehicle, then this bill does not prevent a peace officer from pulling that individual over and citing him for that hazard.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier. Be that as it may, I appreciate the fact that the bill does, in fact, allow the enforcement of traffic laws. But be that as it may, the fact of the matter is, based upon the testimony that we've heard, that this impedes one of the primary mechanisms through which law enforcement officers are able to execute warrants that have been lawfully served on individuals for crimes that imply imminent violence or potential violence. To my mind, the only alternative, if we're going to take away this primary avenue of contacting people in the wild, so to speak, then there has to be some sort of proportional increase in the other ways that we seek out people who have had warrants served against them. And that means what? Going to their place of residence, going to their place of employment, assuming they have one, going into, you know, any public space. And in that process of trying to hunt them down to execute a warrant that's been lawfully served, I don't understand how that's going to result in a better outcome than finding them pulled over on the side of the road. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, I'll just say, because right now it's a needle in a haystack. I mean, you can follow somebody's car. If they can look at their license plate number and determine there's a warrant out for them, then they can stop that person. Right now, if you're stopping someone from for having an air freshener hanging from your rearview mirror, then, I mean, the chances that they have a warrant are probably very slim, but you're able to stop people for so many things, for not paying their taxes, essentially, because they have expired tabs. So that's really what we're trying to get at. Right now, it's a needle in a haystack. And that's how I look at it. Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Frazier, I know where you're coming at with this. I understand where your line of thinking is. I'm going to share a personal story that actually happened back in October. I was driving home and driving my wife's car that day. She had expired tabs, month over. And I got pulled over. I looked down at the odometer. Wasn't speeding. And I got asked that question. Do you know why I pulled you over? And I said, no, I don't. And he said, well, you got expired tabs. Just hand me your license, registration, all the yada yada, right? And my birthday was a couple days prior. My license had just expired. And I had a taillight out. So that's like a three whammy. I'm thinking to myself, surefire ticket. I mean, I deserved it. I should have checked the headlight. I knew that it was on my honey-do list, and I didn't take care of it. But the response from the officer was actually something that I took away with some real gratitude. He said, hey, it's just a couple days overdue. Make sure you get that done. The tabs, you want to get that done ASAP. You can actually do it online. That way you don't have to go and wait in line. And if you want to do it all at once, you can even get the license same day. Lakeville has some short lines right now from what I've heard. So that interaction was actually super positive. It was a community interaction where now there's a human behind that badge. There's a human behind that bulletproof vest. We're working collaboratively, and we see each other as equals. We're both being respectful. And so to hear in testimony that we want to simply limit police interactions, I understand that that's based off of prior interactions that went wrong, right? But to really, truly fix the issues that you're trying to address, having limited interactions would only facilitate more distrust. And so I'm taking a look at your approach to this, and I'm kind of on the other side of it. Can you talk to me specifically about why limiting those interactions is a net positive?
Representative Fisher.
Yeah, thank you for that sharing your story about your triple whammy there. Yeah. I'm glad you didn't get a citation for that and you got to take care of it. The limitations are based on, the story you're telling, and I have to be frank about this, you're a white male that was pulled over. What we're talking to is we're looking at the disparities where we see when there's brown and black folks pulled over, where those interactions are not always so positive. And so that's what we're trying to address in those situations. Our thought is that if you can limit those interactions that could heighten and escalate, right, to a situation, you're better off because now you don't have folks that have that type of interaction and that type of memory and that type of perspective to ground them in a negative way toward law enforcement. And that is the idea of the legislation.
One final comment or question, Representative Inga.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier. I thought that was going to be the response. I left this part out. He didn't look like me. He was a black man. We did not share the same pigmentation or melanin, but we shared an awesome interaction. And so just to phrase it in that context, I think, is a little bit sideways. I think that it doesn't recognize the full humanity of the interaction, too. So just wanted to include that.
Madam Chair, may I respond to that?
Yep, go ahead.
Thank you. And I thought you were going to say that. So let me say this. It doesn't matter that individual didn't look like you. It does matter what you look like. That's why I shared that part about that. I've had interactions with officers that are white, with officers that are not white, and I've had some negative interactions with both of those, with those officers in each of those situations. The common denominator was that I am a black man in all of those situations. So I wouldn't say just because that individual didn't look like you that changed the way that wouldn't change the way that ultimately was the reason why that interaction was better or not. The bias, anybody can have bias. Anybody can have assumptions about someone. It doesn't matter what race you are. That is one of the, what I would say is one of the things about, particularly in this country, those type of biases permeate us all. And when we have these biases and when we've been told from the moment that we can remember and understand that certain people will react this way or are doing certain things, those biases carry on. And it doesn't matter what color or what race you are, they can permeate you and they will play out in certain ways.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing this bill. So I guess you said a lot of what I was going to say in response to that story. And one of the things I wanted to bring to everybody here's attention is the book We Are All Criminals, which is a fantastic book about the fact that we all have done things that are criminal, right? Driving with an expired license, expired tabs. Like, we all have done things that we're not supposed to do. But the reality is there is a select group of people that get over penalized for those situations. And I think that's exactly what this bill is trying to get at. And I'll push it a little step further because Representative Frazier was saying that everybody can be biased. But the reality is the studies show that everybody is biased. And there's no way you can control that. You are biased to different extents, but we all have bias, especially when it comes to race, but also gender, age, sexual orientation, all sorts of things. And so one of the things I used to do diversity, equity, inclusion work. And so one of the things that we would often talk about is that you cannot necessarily rid yourself of bias, but you can make yourself more aware. And what I see in this bill is that we're not trying to control what law enforcement is doing. We're simply trying to get some data so we can be more aware of how to proceed going forward and to see if there are some changes that systemically we can make to reduce those negative interactions. I think this is a really responsible way of proceeding forward, and I commend you for bringing this bill forward in the form that it's in, because we cannot make
changes to a system without having information in front of us. And this is going to give us more information. So thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair. And I just want to remind folks, I think you're aware of this, that in Ramsey County we've had for a couple years now a policy of that when there's a traffic stop, it's not for a public safety reason. And so it's a, and it's actually a pretty limited list, but akin to what's being discussed here. But that's something that that then we will not proceed with the case, that essentially saying that those are stops that, that should be, that we should not be pursuing. And the justification for that came a lot from a study showing that that there is racial bias in stops, just in the them being pulled over. And one of the ways that you can be aware of that, as I recall from this study, is that there was a racial disparity in the stop when it's during the day and much less at night. Because in the day you can see into the car, it would be the theory, because otherwise there would be no reason to think there'd be a difference. And that there's quite a bit of a difference there when it's the daytime versus the nighttime. In any case, that's something that's been working quite well in our county, and I really appreciate your leadership and work on this, Representative Frazier. Thanks, Chair.
Lead Novotny.
Chair Mueller, Representative Frazier. a lot better than it was. Thank you for at least doing that. My question that I have in the line 1.4, peace officer making a traffic stop for a violation of this chapter or chapter 168, and the word I just find troubling is must inform the vehicle's operator of the reason for the stop before engaging in questioning related to this suspected traffic stop. What is going to happen if from the time the cars come to a stop and the officer has that chance to explain why they were stopped, something happens? Might be anecdotal. And speaking with members of the State Patrol, just how confrontational some of these stops have been, that they don't even get to the point of explaining where or why the stop was made. So what's going to happen under your law that now we'll go back to that same, they did a traffic stop, this traffic stop goes sideways before they can do their legally mandated explanation of why the stop was made. What is going to happen to anything that happens after that? Any discovery, any use of force after that, that if the mandatory language wasn't used? I would think if we could have just a little bit more clarification on the must and a little allowance whenever feasible, whenever possible, there'd be a lot less heartburn, but I think we're setting people up for a real bad situation to develop with this word without a little more clarification.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Novotny, Lead Novotny, we can, I'm definitely willing to have that, talk about that and have that conversation. But the idea is that you're talking about a scenario where the officer actually pulls the vehicle over, gets to get to the window, gets to start the conversation. If it's a situation where things are escalated before he even gets to the window, I would expect that officers to use their training to de-escalate that situation before carrying out that process. And I would anticipate that that wouldn't be a problem if you can articulate that this thing, when cameras are on, so we would be able to see that this thing escalated before that officer even had the chance to engage in that conversation.
Yeah, and I would just, you know, for the second part of the sentence is before engaging in questioning related to a suspected traffic violation. So at that point, if something else has happened, you're not even talking about, yeah, I pulled you over because you have expired tabs. You wouldn't have to say that because you're moving on to whatever it is that's next. It's just if you're going to question somebody about the reason for the stop. But go ahead, Lead Novotny.
Chair Mueller, I understand your point, but I live in Realville, and I read words and statutes for what they say, and must to me means must. This is a situation where I can see this is going to be, once again, it'll be drug into court, and you have no allowance in this for when possible. This is must, and must means must. That's my objection, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we move on to closing comments, too, I'll just say it sounds like Representative Frazier is certainly open to discussing that language, which is great. I live in Realville, too, and I did read the entire sentence together, didn't just stop at must, but read it to the end, to the period. So, you know, I also want to just say my interest in this not only was as a result of what happened to Dante Wright, but Philando Castile. I mean, I was really struck when I heard that he was stopped by police 46 times. He was only 32 years old when he was killed and had been stopped 46 times and racked up more than $6,000 in fines. That was sort of a life-altering moment for me as a white person who didn't have that same experience. And so I think, you know, when we worked on this language before, we heard from law enforcement that the mandatory secondary stops, the presumptive secondary offense, that was really confusing. And they wanted to just know, like, if something's not illegal, make it not illegal. Make those air fresheners not illegal. Make it not illegal to have expired tabs. We want to collect those taxes in another way, but let's not stop people in their cars for not paying those taxes. That's what we heard from them. And so, you know, to Amber Jones's testimony, thank you. And I really apologize that we didn't get this comprehensive work done sooner. When we started to dig into these laws, our code was just kind of a mess. Like, lights are in every different section. And I own that, and I'm really sorry that we couldn't get this comprehensive reform done sooner, because I really would love to be passing that this year. But you have my commitment, and to anybody listening, and I hope people across the aisle will work on this together. We did have some bipartisan agreement with us before about not being able to pull people over for not paying their taxes. That was something that appealed to other members across the aisle as well. And I hope we can work collaboratively and come back with a really great bill next year that all the stakeholders have agreed on. So thank you, Representative Frazier, for all your work on this. And if you could give closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking forward to continuing this work. And I'm obviously absolutely always open to working across the aisle with folks to get this done. I think we can do something that could really be helpful and transformative in the state of Minnesota. I just want to remind folks we're not far removed from Philando Castile. And I will just note Officer Yanas was not a white officer, you know, just to make that clarity and that point there. You know, we're not far removed from Philando Castile. We're not far removed from George Floyd. We're not far removed from Dante Wright. And so we still have some things that we have to address. And as long as we're not far removed, as long as people remember, as long as things keep happening in the state, we're going to continue to be in the spotlight. And I think we can lead on this. We can lead on a way to transform how our law enforcement engages with our community and how our community sees law enforcement. And so I'm hoping that we can do that together. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Frazier renews the motion and lays over House File 1832 as amended. Representative Cagle, are you still here? So sorry. Thank you for hanging with us. I will move that House File 3697 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Cagle, I don't believe you have any amendments, so welcome to the committee, and please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's past my bedtime, and I had Girl Scout cookies for dinner, so I apologize if I'm not 100% focused right now. But what House File 3697 does is, right now the current problem is that Interlock does not take into account drugs. So if you are, you can still shoot up some heroin, get in your car, and blow clean and drive. And so what this bill does is separates drug DWIs from alcohol DWIs. If you have an alcohol-only related incident, you would then still have to get the breathalyzer ignition interlock. If you have a drug-only DUI, you don't have to get the breathalyzer, but you must participate in an intensive testing program. And if you do both, then you're just lucky and get both of them. So that is what this bill does, and just really make sure that we are testing for, you know, I think wanting the punishment to fit the crime is really what it is. And this actually is a bill that I've worked on personally. It wasn't brought to me by any lobbyist or constituent, but March 29th, 2016 was the last time my brother used heroin. And he still has an ignition interlock in his vehicle right now. And
he could still be using drugs and be completely clean on the program. And so I also have a testifier here with me. Josh Solom is a certified peer recovery specialist and also the creator and co-host of Addiction to Recovery podcast, which he hosts with one of my colleagues on the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council, Dr. Heather Bell. So I just really want to thank him for driving down here from Little Falls. So.
Right. Welcome to the committee. And my apologies and thank you so much for waiting so long. Please go ahead with your testimony. No,
thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Cagle and members of the committee. Like I said, I'm a person in long-term recovery from drug and alcohol.
Can you just state your name for the record?
I'm Joshua Solom. Like I said, I'm a peer recovery specialist, co-host of Addiction to Recovery, and I'm a person in long-term recovery from drug and alcohol abuse. I last was using meth up until 2 years ago. I was in a car accident, and I ended up crashing my car and having a pretty substantial injuries and everything, but I was convicted of a DWI, and I was put on Intoxiloc, and I haven't had an alcoholic beverage since 2016, and not once did that device even test for meth. As Representative Cagle said, that doesn't test for heroin, it doesn't test for meth, it doesn't test for inhalants. Basically, if you had alcohol in it, it would not let you start your car. That's it. And you know, there's a lot to this, the Intoxiloc, that I could probably get on a soapbox because I've had to experience it now for a year. And I was lucky. I had a friend that just passed away after 5 years of sobriety. He had he was a heroin addict, and I went through Teen Challenge with him. He was sober for 5 years. He had a situation where he was giving a ride home to a girl, a friend of his, who had been drinking. He drove her car in Crookston, Minnesota, where there is no Ubers. So I'm telling you, there's not a chance to just call an Uber in that situation. She was drinking. He drove her car. It was about a month away from his release date from Intoxiloc. He got pulled over. His Intoxiloc got extended by 5 years, and he just overdosed after 5 years of sobriety and died. He was one semester away from becoming an LADC. He was on the dean's list, and don't know the details, but I know that his Intoxiloc prevented him from going up to a wedding that he was supposed to be the best man in. And I'm convinced that that was part of it. After 5 years of being on Intoxiloc, he couldn't get off because of the one mistake he made, which was a mistake which we would all want him to do again, and that was drive somebody home. The other thing I want to talk about, now this isn't about this, but if you all know what the rules are about texting and driving, I think you should go and sit in a car with somebody who's got the Intoxiloc system. We're not supposed to be touching our phones, but yet every 7 minutes we got a device that's blaring at us to blow into the machine, and it's like this. I'll demonstrate it. It's 1, 2, 3, exhale, inhale for 2, exhale for 3. I can send texts a lot faster than that, people. And you have to concentrate on this. And I'm telling you that the reason why they do this, and I'm on a soapbox here, is they want you to get tripped up. You shouldn't have to blow into the machine every 7 minutes. You shouldn't have to blow into the machine, period, after you get the car started. I went through this for a year, and there were so many times where I'm driving down the street, and the machine, the little blower thing comes off, and then you don't have anything to blow into. And now the thing's going to scream at you, and you got to go try and find this thing on the floor. This is not a safe device, people. I'm telling you, this is not a safe device. And I get it. You know, it's the alcohol. It can find alcohol in your system. But there's so much issues with drugs. The reason I do what I do is because we have 308 people die every day of overdose. 300 people die every day of overdose. That's like if a 757 dropped out of the sky every day. I don't think that we would be sitting on our hands doing nothing about that. But this is part of it. We're not doing anything to help people that have heroin addiction. We're not doing anything to help people that have meth addiction. We're punishing them, and we're getting them into a system that they can't get out of. Not to even mention the cost of this thing. I had to pay $30 every 6 weeks to get it recalibrated. Recalibrated, I don't even know what that means. Then I had to pay another $73 every 2 weeks just to have the service. And then on top of everything else, I had to pay them to take it out of my vehicle. So I feel like this is a system that is taking advantage of people that don't have a voice like myself. I was a school teacher for 10 years. I was a hockey coach for 10 years. I happened to get caught up in the OxyContin epidemic. I lost everything because of it. Now I have a voice. I want to use my voice. And so this is the first time I hope I'm up here trying to convince people to, like, let's do some more for the people that are stuck in addiction and not punish them.
Thanks for your testimony. I think we all just learned a lot that we have seen us making some eye contact over here. So thank you so much for your testimony. Really appreciate it. Anybody else from the public wish to testify on this bill? Not seeing any, so we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Cagle. The only comment I'll make is that if it was within our rules to offer verbal amendments, I would say let's end that nonsense right now with the every 7 minutes. That's insane.
Well, let's look at that bill next year. For sure. Any other discussion? All right. Representative Cagle, closing remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, you know, this bill is really key to making sure that the punishment fits the crime and that we're keeping our roads safe and that we're also making sure that folks who are suffering with addiction and recovery have a way to get out. And so that's something that I'm really excited about. I know that there's some things that we have to work on with DPS as far as language and getting rules and all that kind of fun stuff. And the one thing that I kind of keep thinking about, too, with this bill is, you know, ignition interlock. If you blow into it and you have alcohol, it stops your car. And so that's kind of one of the things that, you know, I'm struggling with to figure out how we're going to solve that problem is, you know, if a test pops positive, how do we make sure that that car, and I keep going back to our repo bill that we had a few years ago where the car companies were putting those things in the cars and then if they didn't make a payment, they'd lock it so that the repo person could come find it. And so, you know, maybe we kind of repurpose that technology for this and figure out a way to really make our roads safe, make sure that the punishment fits the crime and that we're getting people out of addiction. So. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for all your work on this over the years. Appreciate it.
I'm sure everybody's sick of me talking about it. I know Jordan over here is laughing at me right now. he's happy I will never talk about this bill again if we get it passed.
All right. With that, I will renew the motion that House File 3697 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. The motion prevails. Thanks again for being patient with us, and we will see you all tomorrow morning. The meeting is adjourned.